And that's it. We are live. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of In Liberty and Health. And today I have somebody that is very, very well educated on a topic that I take great interest in. I do a lot of reading and learning and trying to learn everything I can about this particular subject. So I'm sure today will be a very, very fruitful conversation for not only myself, but hopefully all the listeners as well. So before we get into today's conversation, please go to all the links below where you can find my guest, everything he's got going on, ways you can support him and all that good stuff. And then obviously I got a new affiliate through Tiger Fitness. So if you're looking to get any kind of supplements, as you can see, the pre-workouts, branch chains, protein powders and all that. If you're looking to get any of that, go to tigerfitness.com/KyleM and use code Kyle at checkout to get a little discount. I think they're still running their New Year's discount where you get some free ebooks and stuff like that. So feel free to head over there and get some supplements. Fox and Sons Coffee through the code below. Use code Kyle at checkout to let Steve know that I sent you and get some wonderful, wonderful coffee. And of course, Deemed Fit through the link below to support the Metovic family as well. Let them know that I sent you Sarah M25 at checkout. And without further ado, let's get into our conversation today all about China, Taiwan, America, and I'm sure much more.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
All right. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whenever you're listening. And I'd like to welcome to the show Mr. Ken Hammond. How are you?
I'm well. Glad to be here, Kyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't you tell the audience who you are and what you do?
Okay. Well, I'm a historian. I'm a professor at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is a beautiful part of the country down here in the desert southwest. We're about 35 miles north of the Mexican border. I teach in the history department, and I'm a historian of China primarily, although I teach world history, global history as well. Been here about 30 years, and just enjoying the life.
Yeah, of course. Nice. Well, one thing that I found particularly interesting about you, and I think you talked about this a little bit when you were on, I think it was Breakthrough News, and there was another radio interview I listened to of you, where you mentioned you were at Kent State, which is about 2 hours away from me, and I used to drive past there a lot because I lived in Fairview Park, Ohio for a little bit. So, if you wouldn't mind, would you like to kind of let the audience know what that was like for you, and specifically at the times of the protests?
Sure. Yeah, I was at Kent. I grew up in suburban Cleveland, and Kent was the local school, and so I went down there. I started there in 1967. I got involved with anti-Vietnam War activities. My brother was in Vietnam. My older brother was over in Vietnam, so I was very concerned about all that. You know, got involved with some of that stuff. So I was, around for the events in 1970 when soldiers were on campus. There'd been some protests and this and that. And, they fired into a crowd of students and four people were killed and nine others were wounded. And, that was obviously kind of a big deal. I was one of 25 people that were indicted by a grand jury for that, although eventually all those charges were dropped. It was a pretty crazy time, and was just part of my sort of ongoing education about politics and power and the world and things like that.
Yeah. Does it kind of give you pause when you look out at college campuses today? And I consider myself a little bit more on the right-leaning side of the political spectrum. But, when I see kids on college campuses who really aren't harming anybody but are protesting what is definitionally a genocide by every single account, definition, and, by what's going on over in Gaza, does it concern you when you see how they're willing to send in the military to stop these protests over a foreign country?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the situation in the country as a whole and the situation on our campuses these days is about as tense and confrontational as it has been for many, many years. You know, I still do a lot of speaking. I speak on different topics, mostly China stuff. But of course, every so often, every year when the anniversary of Kent State comes around, I get asked to talk about that. And young people are always asking exactly that question, you know, how do you see things today and all that? And I got to say, I mean, I think on the one hand that it's extremely encouraging and it's really great that young people are out there being active. You know, my own perspective, I have my own perspectives on a lot of issues, but I just like to see young people out there being active kind of no matter what their perspective is, because as a historian, you know, my feeling is history is what we make it, what we, the people, have to make it, you know. And so whatever your views, whatever your beliefs, if you're just an ordinary person, you should be out there trying to promote those ideas and trying to promote those attitudes, you know. And so I think that it's a time on the one hand that's very encouraging because so many young people are being, you know, stimulated and facing the issues that we all are confronting these days. You know, it's good to have people out there. On the other hand, I think that the reaction of university administrations and certainly of a lot of, you know, kind of mainstream politicians has been pretty awful. The willingness to send in, you know, the cops and some people talking about, you know, mobilizing like the National Guard and things. Obviously, that's quite resonant with my own experience. So I think that that's a very scary aspect of our present situation. And I think that, you know, we'll see how things develop going forward. There doesn't seem to be any indication or any sign of the terrible war that's going on in Gaza, you know, letting up. If anything, Israel seems to be intent upon expanding its military activities as broadly as possible, not only into Lebanon and Syria, now attacking down in Yemen. You know, the concerns about a wider regional war have been realized, and the United States, you know, the politicians in certainly in the Biden administration, but in previous administrations have all just stayed pretty much in lockstep with Israel. And there doesn't, as I say, there doesn't seem to be any sign of that abating. So I think that we're likely to see continued concerns, continued protests. And I just hope that those could go forward without the kind of violence and loss of life that we saw, you know, 54, 55 years ago now. I think that I'm happy to see people return to the streets and return to activism. I hope that we don't see a revival of the kind of state repression that was so kind of characteristic of that period.
Yeah. And maybe I should take a little bit more of an optimistic note in the respect that people are out there being active again. As you hear in a lot of the corner of the more right-leaning internet, they said, oh, the whole anti-war left had gone away with the Obama administration. And I mean, you know, fair enough. But at the same time, now that there are kids back that are chanting against, you know, what's going on in Gaza, it is pretty encouraging to see people saying that they've had enough of, you know, our billions of our tax dollars going over there, you know, just to blow up, you know, one of the poorest countries in the entire planet.
Yeah. Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I think that, you know, I think that there's an interesting almost convergence sometimes of people who are, you know, some people at least who think of themselves as being on the left, and other people who, you know, I think perhaps somewhat like yourself, think of themselves as being a little more right leaning, but in that kind of libertarian way, you know, that I think that there are ways in which what we're sharing are common concerns. And I think that when we look at, yeah, just the flushing of so many billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, probably trillions of dollars overall, down to these foreign wars that really don't have anything to do with the needs of the American people. You know, and they're making defense corporations rich and others, you know. I mean, it's a rough and bad situation. And I think that, I don't know, it's a double-edged sword. I'm encouraged by the revival of activism, but I'm anxious about how the state is going to respond.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I share that concern very much so. Before we hopped on here, funny enough, I was looking, just scrolling through Twitter, seeing kind of what's going on in the world. You know, obviously there's been a lot going on just in these last 2 days with some of the unfortunate loss of life recently. But one of the things that came up over in the corner of like where it said discovery was China sanctions, I think it was 28 weapons lobbies for over arms sales to Taiwan. So I don't know how much you, well, I'm sure you keep up with this quite a bit, but maybe this is where we kind of get into a little bit of what's your seeming passion and obviously your expertise, which would be, why would China be so concerned about that little island that we call Taiwan, and why would they sanction the U.S. for sending them weapons?
Well, that puts it quite succinctly. Historically, if we look back, hundreds and hundreds of years, the island of Taiwan has been, part of the sort of Chinese community, I suppose you could say. It has been part of the imperial state under the late Ming Dynasty, under the Qing Dynasty. So that goes back at least to the 15th century, 14th century. Today, of course, the government on the island refers to itself as the Republic of China. The greatest historical collection of Chinese culture, of Chinese art, is in the Palace Museum, which is housed in Taipei. The relationship between the island and the rest of the country is one. If you buy a map, if you're in Taipei and you buy a map in a bookstore of the country that you're in, the Republic of China, it shows the whole place. It shows, the island, it shows the mainland. That's their view, is that they're the government of the whole country. If you buy a map on the mainland, it looks exactly the same, only it has the word People's in it, People's Republic of China. That's the difference, is the names. So the idea that this part of China, this province of China, should be sort of split away from the rest of the country, not so much by the internal dynamics of politics in China, but with this tremendous encouragement and really intervention on the part of the United States, which formally, legally, recognizes the government in Beijing as the only government of all of China, and even recognizes that people on both sides of the strait agree that this is something that should be resolved by them in their own way. Why we say one thing and then do a very, very different set of things. Not that this is by any means the only instance where we see that, but that's something that I think is quite problematic. The problem of the status of Taiwan is something that is a hangover from 75 years ago, the end of the Civil War, the revolutionary struggle in China. And that's just a fact of history. How that gets resolved really should be done without outside intervention, interference, all this kind of stuff. So from the perspective of the government on the mainland, of the leadership in Beijing, what they want is for the United States to honor the commitments that it has made repeatedly in these formal agreements to stay out of it and not to provide military assistance, certainly not to upgrade and enhance that military assistance. Mm-hmm. In ways that are really kind of stressing the whole situation out, that doesn't need to be that way, Mm-hmm. So I think that, they're going to impose these sanctions on American, weapons corporations. I don't think that's going to have a dramatic effect on anybody. It's a gesture more than any kind of meaningful, it's not going to have an economic impact on those corporations. But I think that it's an important, it is exactly that. It's a gesture. It's a political statement saying, look, this is none of your business and you shouldn't be doing this. And, this is just what we can, this is how we can express ourselves about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I remember when I first started learning about this issue, probably about maybe 2-3 years ago, a friend of mine was trying to explain this to me, and he did a wonderful documentary called The Stain of the Century, where he kind of debunked the whole Uyghur genocide claim, right? Where I've heard you explain this at length, and everybody that I know that's very knowledgeable on this subject usually comes to the same conclusion, usually explains it in a very, very similar way that makes a lot of sense. But we can get into that in a little bit. But sure. I remember I was kind of asking him about how could you compare this to any other kind of situation maybe with like the U.S.? You can't quite compare it to Hawaii because, we kind of conquered Hawaii and that's always just kind of been there. You can't really compare it to some of the other territories. Like, this is just, there's such a long-standing history between Taiwan and China. And on top of that, my understanding is, and you could elucidate upon this further, the people in China and Taiwan both look at each other like family, because, I mean, we're talking about an island that's only, what, 70 miles off the coast of China. They trade, they go back and forth between the mainland and, you know, Taiwan. So these people don't look at themselves as enemies. I mean, they look at themselves like, you know, I would look at you as somebody that just lives across the country that's of, you know, another fellow person in the United States.
Yeah, you know, I that's exactly right. And you know, even today, even with the level of tensions that have kind of been in place because of, you know, certain political elements on the island, there's still millions and millions of people who go back and forth every year because the families are so interconnected. You know, the separation that took place in 1949, you know, for a long time until the 1980s, there wasn't a lot of contact between the mainland and the island. But since then, you know, that has opened up. There have been a number of agreements. You can fly directly now from Shanghai to Taipei. You don't have to go around, you know, through Hong Kong and all this kind of rigmarole you used to have to do. There's, you know, there's tour groups that go in both directions, individuals that travel in both directions. There's 600,000 people from the island who live on the mainland working in different businesses. And, you know, it's just the economies are so deeply intertwined that, you know, the idea that somehow these are kind of separate entities, it's not reflected in the reality of all those relationships, personal, social, cultural, economic. They're all very, very closely integrated. You know, in terms of parallels, of course, one way that it's a little, I mean, obviously it's a different, very different set of issues and all that, but in terms of sort of a formal or political question, you know, the United States fought a civil war, the bloodiest war in American history, over, you know, not allowing part of the country to secede based upon its desire to follow a different socioeconomic path, right? And, you know, so the idea that you know, we were willing to say, look, this country, which at that point wasn't even 100 years old as a you know, single political unit, this country's not going to put up with that. We're going to wage a war. We're going to, you know, kill 680,000 American soldiers on both sides altogether, mm-hmm. Because we think that this should remain a single country. As you say, the historical framework is so completely different. We're not talking about, you know, 80 years. We're talking about, you know, maybe 800 years of being part of the same, you know, the same system. And so, you know, I think that's obviously a very different set of specific circumstances. But I think that Americans sort of, when they hear about Taiwan and they hear about, oh, they should just be able to be independent because everybody wants to be independent. That's not really the question. You know, the question is, you know, let's look at your own history. Look at what we've done. I mean, obviously, things like Hawaii, you know, Puerto Rico. I mean, there's lots of ways in which you could talk about specific sort of circumstances that are more similar. But I think the fundamental principle of not wanting to see secessionism or whatever you want to call it, you know, it's kind of ironic to hear American politicians get all wrapped up about this when they, you know, when they're part of a government that, as I say, fought this massive and bloody war on exactly the same issue.
Right. So another thing that was a little bit tricky for me to understand, and I would like for you to touch on this as well, was I was asking him about, like, okay, well, why don't the arms sales kind of set off a bunch of red flags, you know, over in China over when the U.S. sends arms to Taiwan? And he said, no, actually, like, mostly what really angers the mainland is actually the congressional delegations over, because that seems to be more symbolic. So go ahead, touch on that and kind of why you think that it angers China more that they send congressional delegations versus arms over.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a fundamental difference between those encounters or those engagements, because on the one hand, arms sales, while it is true that they are in a violation of the commitments that the American government has made repeatedly, nonetheless, they're, you know, essentially commercial transactions. Although often, you know, the way that these work, and these work this way, this works this way with many other countries, is that the United States provides the money to that government so that they can then use that money to buy American weapons from private corporations. You know, I mean, it's a kind of a bizarre economic set of relationships. But those things go on with many countries around the world, and so that's okay. That's one thing. But the visits, you know, think of Speaker Pelosi's visit most particularly. Mm-hmm. I mean, here you have Nancy Pelosi, the person third in line for the succession to the presidency at that point. Actually second in line for the succession, but, you know, third in that ranking. And like, here she is going there and basically acting as though she's making a state visit to an independent country. Right. That's a political gesture. That's a political statement, which, you know, is a reflection of how America's political elites are positioning themselves, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's seen as more of an in-your-face kind of attitude than the arms sales. You know, the arms sales, obviously, these you know, the whole military-industrial complex thing that we know about from President Eisenhower. Yeah. You know, that's bad enough, but it's in some ways comprehensible. But the sort of egregious nature of these is usually the congressional visits, and also when Taiwanese politicians, especially from the DPP, want to come and visit in the United States and meet with government officials here. I mean, are you going to respect your word? You're going to honor your word or not? Mm-hmm. And if you're not, then, you know, how are we going to have a viable and understandable relationship going forward?
Right. Now, I guess to maybe put a little bit of a bow on that, you could tell me if this summarizes it accurately. So that basically, we have the one China principle where we recognize that Taiwan is part of China. When there are congressional delegations and Taiwanese officials come over here to America, or, you know, in other situations where we have Taiwanese troops training up in Michigan, let's say, yeah. Xi and China kind of look at that as, we're saying, no, we're beginning to recognize Taiwan's independence, even though we've promised you that we wouldn't. Does that sound accurate to you?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. The force, you know, the main force driving, you know, whatever agitation towards independence for Taiwan, the main force is American political elites, American, mm-hmm. you know, political administrations, not, you know, there's not a mass movement on Taiwan calling for independence. There is a proportion of the population that would like to see that, but there's a much greater proportion of the population that either would just like to continue things as they are, just muddle through, or actively seek some greater, you know, reintegration with the mainland. So, you know, the DPP, the Democratic People's Party, that is, that holds the presidency now, although it is not the majority party in the legislature. You know, that president was elected by less than 40% of the vote because it was a three-way race, and the other two candidates combined, although neither of them, you know, got that much, they together got over 60%. So, you know, it's a clear majority of people did not vote for an independence-oriented leader, you know. And I think that we lose the sort of fine grain of that in mainstream media coverage of all this here in the United States. Mm-hmm.
So I one thing I would be pretty curious to learn about, and you know, maybe you know much more than I do, because I've talked to quite a few people about this. The three political parties, there's the DPP, the Democratic People's Party, who are, to my understanding, very independence-minded. The Kuomintang, which are okay with kind of the status quo, and I always forget the third one. Can you kind of explain those three parties and how they kind of seek and see themselves with respect to China?
Yeah, I mean, the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, the KMT, as they call it on Taiwan. That is that they were the governing party for many, many years, of course. They kept Taiwan under martial law until the end of the 1980s. But even after that, they remained the governing party. And they still, you know, the president, not the current president or the previous president, but the one before that, so like two presidents back, was a Kuomintang president. They're still a pretty obviously pretty prominent political force. They are the largest party in the legislature itself. Mm-hmm. And their view is that, you know, it's one country, and they would like to negotiate a final settlement to the that question, but that what they want is a single China. You know, the DPP, of course, is they don't overtly say that they want to declare independence. They will say informally, their politicians will say informally, well, we don't need to declare independence because functionally we are independent, you know. Mm-hmm. But they are, yeah, they're the sort of pro-independence group. And the third group, which is very recent and isn't really a substantial party, it's built around a couple of sort of prominent political figures. Interestingly, one of the things that's sort of curious but also important about them is that they seem to have a lot of appeal to younger people. Mm. I think for a lot of younger people, they're kind of like, look, we don't want to keep having this whole thing of hashing it out. Should we be independent? Should we be part of the mainland? We just want to go on with our lives, you know? We want to study and get jobs and make money and raise families and all this kind of stuff. They're the smallest of the three parties. Sure. But they occupy an interesting sort of niche.
Mm-hmm. So how do you kind of see those three parties operating going forward? If I recall correctly, and you can correct me if I'm mistaken, I think the Biden-Harris administration were kind of preferential to the DPP because obviously over the last 4 years, as much as most people of the, you know, Make America Great Again base, despite what they think, Biden was very, very hawkish towards China and did a lot to kind of stick their face in it.
Sure.
How do you think the current administration is going to play with a coming Trump presidency?
You mean how do I think that the Trump administration will work about
with the DPP?
With the DPP. I think the DPP, because they control the presidency in Taiwan, I think that, you know, they'll continue to have a pretty positive relationship with whatever administration is in the White House. I think that you know, it remains to be seen what the second Trump administration is going to do policy-wise towards China. I think that from what we can see of the appointments that are being made, there doesn't seem to be a clearly defined position yet. There are some people in the shaping up new administration who I think want to continue a lot of the confrontational attitude and
the Waltz, the Rubio, the Elbridge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Kind of keep the whole trade war thing going. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, of course, you have Elon Musk, who is heavily invested in China, and I think has a, if nothing else, a much more pragmatic kind of attitude to that relationship. And I think that I was reading something recently. I'm not sure. I don't remember exactly where, but the idea that you know, could Trump be the new Nixon? Which, you know, is not a comparison I think we normally make, but the idea that just as people say only Nixon could go to China, maybe only Trump can resolve these tensions. You know, can he come up with some dramatic breakthrough that wouldn't, you know, I mean, it's not going to completely resolve all the issues. There are clearly substantive issues between the United States and China in that relationship to make it work. But maybe he, you know, would be in a position to have some new initiative. Who knows? That's the thing. I think going into this, it's not at all clear what's going to emerge. But I think that whatever goes on, for the foreseeable future, certainly the next few years until the electoral cycle goes around again in Taiwan, the DPP is going to be that's the presidency. That's who the relationship will be with. And I think that that's just the way the cards have been dealt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess, kind of moving on from Taiwan, what has the U.S.-China relationship been like over the last, let's say, since World War II? Because World War II is really when the U.S. kind of established itself as, you know, as awful as it may sound, as kind of an empire.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the United States, of course, emerges from World War II as, you know, the most powerful economy in the world. It because of both World War I and World War II, and you know, debts that France and Britain in particular incurred in the course of those wars to the United States. The United States emerges from World War II, A, with its industrial economy intact, and B, as the new financial center. London is eclipsed by New York. The United States is the U.S. dollar replaces the British pound as the global currency, and that sets up a whole new era. When the People's Republic is established in 1949, that becomes a part of the whole Cold War thing, the confrontation between a Western bloc centered around the United States, with the United States as the clear and dominant center, and an Eastern bloc centered around the Soviet Union, with the Soviet Union as the clear and dominant center. And that, you know, China sort of gets subsumed under that, which certainly was not inaccurate in 1949, 1950. But in the course of the 50s, deep tensions developed between China and the Soviet Union. The Chinese leadership did not want to follow the same kind of top-down path that the Soviets had under Stalin and even later. There were fundamental differences that began to appear. There were differences within the Chinese leadership, of course, that led to all kinds of turmoil. But a lot of that came down to different paths, different ways of going about their you know, efforts to develop their economy. During those years, because of the Cold War, the United States basically had an antagonistic posture toward China, and certainly China had an antagonistic posture towards the United States, or at least towards the American government. And so that was a very difficult time. We had crises. Of course, we had the Korean War. We had the crises over Taiwan, over the Taiwan Strait, some of the little islands just off the coast there, some of which are like a mile away from the mainland, but are still held by nationalist forces. So that was a tense decade, the 1950s. The 60s kind of lingered on in that mode, even though the Chinese and the Soviets split 1959, 1960. And by the end of the 60s, 1969, they're fighting border wars with each other. It took a long time for the United States political, you know, and intelligence, I think, community to take that seriously. So the 60s kind of is a hangover from the 50s. But by 1969, you know, the United States is struggling with its situation in Vietnam. The Chinese are, you know, they lost all the assistance, all the aid, all the backing that the Soviets had provided them in the 50s. So they're staggering along with their economy, which is chugging along, but, you know, they're not dynamically growing. And so both sides, the United States and China, are trying to figure out, is there some way that we could get past the last two decades, essentially? And not exactly join forces. It's not like we became, you know, allies in a more traditional sense, but find common ground and common interest, especially vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Some of the Chinese leadership, especially, began to view the Soviet Union as a real threat, a greater threat than the United States. And so you get Nixon going to China, you get Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai shaking hands and all this kind of stuff. and the Shanghai communique that sets out a lot of these principles that we're still grappling with today. And that launches a new phase, the 1980s. After Mao dies in 1976, and then Deng Xiaoping becomes the new leader in 78, and then they launch this whole thing of opening up and inviting foreign investment and a marketized economy. They talk about it as a socialist market economy. That's a whole new phase in the United States, and not just the U.S., but with the U.S. as the Western leaders, the United States embraces that in the hopes that as China develops its economy, especially through the use of markets, that will lead to a political transformation in China. And that, the Communist Party will either simply, go away one way or another, or will be so transformed in its own nature that it can be integrated, China can be integrated into the global capitalist system. And the Chinese, especially, the first decade of reform in the 80s, there's a phrase they have in Chinese about crossing the river by feeling the rocks, that you know where you want to get to, you're not exactly sure, so you got to go real carefully, take it a little bit at a time, you feel the rocks under the water. And that's what the 80s were kind of like, because they didn't, they were trying to figure out how they were going to do this stuff. And the U.S., kind of wanted to see that go forward. Then, of course, we had 1989 and everything that happened with that. And that kind of froze China out again for a while. But, the lure of the markets in China and the lure, especially of the labor market in China for Western corporations was irresistible, right? So you get the re-engagement in the 90s and on into the beginning of the 21st century. That's a period where on the American side, the view is we want to see this play out. We want to see this ultimately result in the liberalization of China's integration into the global capitalist system. From the Chinese side, and Deng Xiaoping, their sort of top leader until he died in 97, he was clear about this. He used to talk about the need, as he put it, to bide time and develop their capabilities, right? Meaning, it's still the Communist Party. They still want to build a socialist economy. Okay, but we don't want to stick it in your face. We're going to take that low key. We're going to put that off to the side here. We're not going to worry too much about that. What we want to do is grow our economy. And so they join the WTO. They sign all these trade agreements, they get deeper and deeper engaged with the capitalist world, because they need investment, they need technology, they need business know-how, right? They want all those things, and God, it worked like crazy. What are they for 20 years? They grew at over 10% a year. It was nutty. It was like. There were all these articles. I keep a file of these headlines going back to the 80s about how China's miracle growth can't last. We still see those all the time now, but it has chugged along a slower pace now, but on a much larger base until we get to the 2008 global economic crisis. And at that point, China, because it has these socialist features, they were able to weather that storm, because there's so much greater state support for even these private businesses, right? And it's at that point, I think, that the light bulb went on for leaders in Washington, especially the Obama administration, but leaders in both parties, that China wasn't going to change. It wasn't going. There was not going to be some color revolution. There's not going to be some, neoliberal takeover. And that leads to, in 2011, that leads to the pivot to Asia under the Obama administration. Secretary of State Clinton writes this article in Foreign Policy, I think it was, about the need for a new American Pacific century and all this kind of stuff. And so then the attitude shifts pretty quickly from we're gonna go along and get along, on the American side, it's now like, whoa, if you're not going to, you know, join us, then we're going to take you down. And on the Chinese side, the attitude is, hey, look, we've accomplished a lot. We've built up our economy. We've enriched the lives of our people. We have the capabilities, technological capabilities, research, innovation, development, all this stuff. We don't have to kowtow to you anymore. We don't have to be so deferential anymore. And you get a new leader there like Xi Jinping, and he's just like, hey, now we're doing it our way, you know? And of course, now we have this much, much different relationship where the United States hopes, and I think it's not going to happen, but their hope is to sort of derail China's development, or at least slow it down significantly with all these sanctions and these embargoes and, you know, the CHIPS Acts and stuff like that. And on the Chinese side, they're just like, you know, they got the rising tide thing going, you know, and so they're, you know, you put sanctions on their chips. Well, you know what? We're going to develop our own. And Huawei, you know, that's supposed to be going down. Now they're the largest selling iPhones in the world, you know, because they develop their own technologies. This idea of thwarting development, it backfires because it doesn't stop them. It just pisses them off, you know? And so that's, you know, that's the situation in which we find ourselves today. China continues to grow. It's growing at, you know, 5% or so a year, which is way down from 10 or 12%. It's still at least twice, if not more, what's going on here. You know, and by some measures, they're already a bigger economy than ours. You know, it's just there's a huge, huge global reconfiguration taking place, and the American elites are trying to stop it. It's not going to be stopped. What they ought to be doing is trying to figure out how to take advantage of it and make the most of it. But instead, they're trying to kind of hold back the tide, which hasn't worked, you know, for it didn't work for King Canute. It's not going to work for the Americans now, you know. How do we approach this in a better way? Well, you know, they don't ask me, but, you know, I think that there ought to be ways in which, you know, a country as wealthy, as prosperous, as well-educated as the United States, there ought to be some people who could figure out a better way to handle this.
Yeah, I have a friend who travels to Africa from time to time. His wife's originally from there, and he spent some time in Namibia. And I remember him saying, I did his podcast a couple months back. He's like, I don't get more hawkish on China every single time I go to South Africa. He's like, I get a little bit weary. And I think some of this comes from like the Bannonite or Mearsheimer view of the world, where they say they want to contain China. But my question always is, okay, well, how are you going to do that? And then second of all, why do you think that the U.S. is such a benevolent actor on the world stage? So on top of all that, you know, the thing that's leveled at China a lot is, I'm sure you're aware of, the Belt and Road Initiative, that this is somehow thrown in China's direction, saying that they're somehow expansionist for doing the Belt and Road Initiative. So I guess what I want to ask you now is, what do you think about the Mearsheimer argument of containing China? And if you can, dive into the Belt and Road Initiative.
Sure. Well, I mean, China's not going to be contained. That's just not going to happen. For one thing, you're trying to contain something that isn't trying to expand. Okay. Right. China's not establishing military bases outside of its own territory. China has one military installation outside of the People's Republic in Djibouti, in the Horn of Africa, which is part of a United Nations peacekeeping effort to deal with the pirates on the Somali coast and those areas. The United States has a base there as well, which in fact is right next door to the Chinese base. So the French have a base there. I mean, that's the only military establishment that China has outside of its own territory. That's not what they're doing, you know? So the idea of containing, it's not an apt description, you know, that's not really what it's about. And the Belt and Road is a good way to kind of see that or get into that. I mean, because the Belt and Road Initiative, which has been around, 12 years now, it's its stated purpose, and as far as we can tell, its actual function is that they want to help to build infrastructure for trade in countries that have been left behind, I suppose you could say, that have been suffering the aftermath or the downstream effects of you know a century or more of European imperialism, European colonialism, economies that had in many instances been vibrant local economies that were then hollowed out and subordinated to the interests of Britain or France or the Netherlands or whatever, and so when the Europeans went home. Those economies, you know, have struggled many times to reorient themselves and to reconstitute themselves. So China, you know, provides financial assistance either in the form of direct investment or in the form of loans, largely for, as I say, for infrastructure construction, ports, railways, airports, pipelines, all this kind of stuff. And that is not a philanthropic endeavor. China's not a charity, right? China, by the early 21st century, certainly by the 20-teens, had reached a point where there was sufficient level of accumulation, that is to say, the government has, you know, both foreign exchange reserves and simply domestic, you know, revenue reserves that are massive, right? And now they can start to use some of those resources to address certain problems. I mean, within the country, things like environmental issues, things like that, poverty elimination, reduction, stuff like that. But internationally, they've devoted significant resources to these infrastructure campaigns. But they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. They talk about what they like to call a win-win relationship. And actually, if you think about what that means, of course it means they're going to win too. They're not doing this to say, oh yeah, we're going to go out there and we're just going to give you this money. You know, go build your port. Here's
at KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
There's a lot of money. Go build your port. No, it's going to be beneficial for China as well. And so, you know, people, some people with certain agendas in the West, they point to China and they say, look, they claim they're helping these countries, but they're making money off this. They're making profits off this. You know, they're getting interest payments off this or whatever. You know, they're using these facilities for their own, you know, business activity. Well, of course they are. That's what it's supposed to do. You know, trade and exchange between two sides or more. You know, and there's a reason that you've got, 120 some countries that have signed up for this in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, even in Europe. You know, because it is beneficial for them. It's not a giveaway. It's not, you know, here's Santa Claus in a red suit. You know, I mean, it's not like that. It's mutually beneficial. Mm-hmm. So it does benefit China. And they're very clear about that. They don't try to hide that. They're not trying to pretend that they're, you know, just out there being Mr. Nice Guy to everybody. You know, they're doing it because it's in their interest as well. Certainly, they're doing it to help these countries develop. China's experience of Western imperialism, you know, that's a real thing for them, you know, and people remember that. And people now, of course, young people today, they hear their grandparents talk about it or they read about it or see a movie about it or something. But it's a real thing, you know. And so I think that when we hear these allegations that, oh, you know, it's debt. You know, they're debt imprisonment or you
debt
know,
trap debt, diplomacy debt is trap what people
or,
say.
Or neo-colonialism or something. That's just nonsense. You know, if you look, take a country like Kenya, you know, because they've been held up in some instances as an example of this. Actually, 82% of Kenyan debt is to American banks and the U.S. government, you know, and of the remaining 12%, I think 8% is owed to China, you know, and China has been great about rescheduling debt, about forgiving debt in ways that the IMF and the World Bank don't do. China doesn't impose political conditions. They don't say, oh, you have to institute an austerity budget, you know, anything like that. They get criticized for that. Oh, they're coddling dictators, you know. Well, you know, we got plenty of dictators that we've been coddled for a long time. Mr. Saudi Arabia or whatever, you know, I mean, come on. So it's just, people obviously need to educate themselves, learn what they can about the realities of what these circumstances are. And I think that to the degree to which we can get that kind of information out, that's sort of the work that we have to be doing.
So one thing that happened over the Biden administration as well was the arms guarantees and the war guarantee to the Philippines over the disputed reefs between China and the Philippines. Let's touch on that a little bit. The disputed reefs are called, I know one of them was Second Thomas Shoal, I think it was called.
That's right.
And yeah, and then what's kind of the relationship there with China and the Philippines? Let's kind of dissect that a little bit.
Sure. That's the whole South China Sea nexus, you know. I mean, the South China Sea is an area that historically, again, going back centuries, has been an area of great economic importance for China. And it's an area where, merchant vessels going to China, coming from China, have gone back and forth. China has been very concerned with that area. Obviously, in imperial times, they didn't have a navy. They weren't out there patrolling things or anything. But, you know, there are Chinese maps that go back, and non-Chinese maps that go back even as far as the 15th, 16th century that show China's concern and China's interest in that area. The current sort of framework for that, that's often referred to, is something called the 9-Line. And if you look at maps that China puts out, there's this line that runs sort of defining the territory of the South China Sea. Interestingly, the 9-Line is not an invention of the People's Republic. That was put in place by the nationalists under the Republic of China, back before the revolution. The People's Republic took that over from the authorities on Taiwan. So again, if you go into a bookstore in Taiwan and you buy a map of the Republic of China, it also has the 9-Line on it. You never hear about that from our politicians, but that's the case, you know. So this is something that is common to the governments on both on the island and on the mainland. So that's an assertion, shall we say, a claim. And China has established itself in possession of a lot of the islands, some of which started out as basically shoals, but you know they've been built up in the same way, for example, that let's say a city like Venice was built up from sandbars and things like that over a long period of time. There's nothing peculiar about this kind of reinforcement and construction work and things like that. Some of those territories are disputed, with other countries. The Philippines disputes some of those. Malaysia disputes some of those. Vietnam disputes some of those. And China acknowledges that there are these disputes. Their position has been that these are things that should be resolved through negotiation between the relevant parties. And again, what the heck is the United States doing involved in this? Why is the United States involved in this? This is 10,000, 12,000 miles away from the United States. Why is this something that we get to say? Why is the U.S. Navy patrolling the South China Sea? I don't see the People's Liberation Army Navy patrolling the Caribbean or the Atlantic coast, you know. What the heck is going on, you know? So it's just, yeah, the position is that these things should be resolved by bilateral negotiations. China and Vietnam, which have sharp disagreements about that, about the claims, that's what they do. They have regular meetings. They talk about them, you know, and in the meantime, there's a kind of status quo that both sides go along with. And that's how that works. Malaysia, you know, they're not really all that engaged in it, but they do have their claims that they reiterate from time to time. The Philippines, which we always need to remember, was an American colony from 1898-99 until 1945, still has this bizarre relationship with the United States. And under the current administration there, the neo-Marcos administration, they have kind of cozied back up to the Americans, made certain military facilities available to the Americans once again. Mm-hmm. And the United States, happy to get involved, has made these supposed guarantees, although it is very unclear exactly what the guarantees mean in terms of, what would have to happen for the United States to militarily intervene in the South China Sea. The United States loves to be provocative, but it's unlikely, I think, to really want to go to war over, you know, a couple of rusted out freighters lodged on a sandbank, you know. Maybe, you know, who knows? Certainly we've blundered into bad situations in the past. I think that, you know, the wars, the proxy wars or whatever that we're involved in now in Ukraine, in Syria, in Gaza, that ought to be enough to keep us busy. But the Biden administration certainly has been intent upon ratcheting things up almost wherever they can. We'll see. Hopefully the Trump administration will take a little more pragmatic, clear-eyed view of this, but I don't think we have a sense yet of what the actual foreign policy stance of the new administration is going to be.
Yeah, I'm kind of heartened to see you at least more optimistic, and I know that sounds a little silly, but I'm pretty, if you will, bearish about that, because Marco Rubio has called for blowing up, you know, airship carriers in the South China Sea. Mike Sure. Waltz is a huge China hawk, and I'm very concerned about the escalations with China and Iran over the next administration.
Well, Iran, for sure. Well, I think the Iran situation is super, super dangerous. Yeah.
Right.
There are the I don't think I'm really optimistic in a sense, but I think that just looking at the situation, it seems like these cabinet and other appointments that have been put out there, none of which, of course, have yet been certified. You know, I mean, this has to happen with the new Congress, but they're so all over the place. You have some people that advocate one thing and some people that advocate exactly the opposite, and yet they're all going to be one team. I don't know exactly how that's going to work.
Yeah, my hypothesis has been pretty much the entire time that you have like the neoconservatives and the Israeli lobby trying to get their piece of the pie. You have the, you know, tech bros trying to get their piece of the pie. And then I'm sure there's, you know, some big banking interests as well. Sure. So like the idea that Trump's like an outsider, and obviously you're not saying this, but like lots of people still argue that. I'm like, he's well established in Washington at this point. It's just who can kind of pick the bones off the corpse, if you will, because Trump really, he's kind of an empty suit. He has, in my opinion, the right kind of instincts where like, hey, we shouldn't be involved. We shouldn't be funding these things. But all it takes is like a finger's push to get him to change his mind and say, oh, no, you know what, hell, you know, we'll bomb Syria, we'll coup Venezuela, we'll, you know, drone strike Soleimani or whatever. I think we're going to see a little bit more of this in the coming 4 years.
Yeah, I do fear that the recklessness will be a challenge.
Yeah, so one other thing that kind of gets talked about a little bit in regards to the U.S. and China is that there's the whole AUKUS situation, which is Australia, the United Kingdom, and then obviously the United States, kind of all in this, not necessarily like NATO type alliance, but it's like a loose coalition. And, a lot of this stuff, and obviously Japan kind of plays a little bit of a part, not in particular this, but also in kind of like the whole, as the United States would call it, the Indo-Pacific kind of pivot to Asia, where they're looking to use South Korea slightly, but, you know, mainly like Japan, the Philippines, and Australia as kind of like unsinkable airship carriers to dock weapons and stuff like that. So I guess let's start with Australia and kind of how they fit into this whole puzzle here.
Well, they are definitely a square peg in a round hole because, China is now Australia's single largest trading partner. And so you would think that rational people would see that as a sign that they might want to try to get along. Right. And yet, Australian politicians seem very intent upon, remaining as closely glued to American positions as possible, and to perpetuating what, of course, for a long time were some pretty seriously racist policies towards Asian people. We have to remember that Australia was, it's basically a 300-year-old or not even that, white settler colony. And the legacy of that in some ways lingers on. So I think that, China has been, I think, pretty restrained in its response to things with Australia. The Australian Navy, they take part in these stupid so-called freedom of navigation provocations in the South China Sea. And it's kind of silly on their part to be doing all this. They've adopted more restrictive policies, for example, towards Chinese students coming to Australia to study, which for a long time, Australia was really the destination of choice. I have good friends in Beijing. Their son went down there and lives in Australia now, and, got an advanced degree and everything. And that window seems to, it has not closed, but it has gotten tighter. And I don't know, Australia seems in some ways to be shooting itself in the foot. But they're doing so enthusiastically. That's certainly the case.
Yeah, it's very odd to me. Now, I remember reading headlines where they would always say, oh, this airplane was navigating irresponsibly in the South China Sea, or like Chinese airship operates irresponsibly in South China Sea. And it'll be a video of like an American ship of some sort, and then a Chinese airship flies past it and shakes it, and they're going on like this is some kind of giant tragedy. But it's like, well, wait, Chinese airship acts irresponsibly in the South China Sea? Like,
right.
Where does America fit into this whole thing?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think that what you outlined about, like, with AUKUS and certainly. The starting with the Obama administration and, carrying on in some ways under Trump and then revived even more with Biden, this idea of the pivot to Asia and the redeployment of American strategic assets and all this kind of stuff. There is clearly a very, very practical effort to encircle China. Yeah, obviously, you can't encircle it, but to create this sort of barrier around it. Again, hearkening back to their old containment mentality. I mean, Joe Biden is like the last of the geriatric cold warriors, and he obviously can't get out of 1962. But, that's been a big deal. What's interesting right now in these last 2 weeks has been that the efforts that the Biden administration had been making, particularly with South Korea and Japan, have started to fall apart. This most recent development, this crazy declaration of martial law by President Yoon and the massive popular revolt against that, and now he's been impeached, and the guy that took over from him, he got impeached. And is he going to be arrested? Is he going to be put on? Who knows what's going on over there? But it certainly reflects that even the United States can only push this stuff so far. Mm-hmm. And, his efforts to sort of stir things up and maybe even provoke some sort of confrontation with the North, that's going by the boards. People don't want that. Right. And Japan, in nowhere near as dramatic a way, but in a very kind of quiet way, The Japanese prime minister over the last 2 weeks paid this very important state visit to China, signed a number of important bilateral agreements, and, really talked about a new era of a relationship with China in a way that just falls off the edge of the table as far as what they've been talking about with the United States. Now, I don't think that that means the United States is out of the picture, either in South Korea or Japan. Of course, we have tens of thousands of troops in both countries. So, you know, I don't think they're really about to chart a totally independent path. But it does suggest that it's not going to be as simple. They're not just going to be the sort of dumb proxies. They don't want to be another Ukraine. You know, they don't want to be in that situation of being the sacrificial victim that we're happy to, you know, pour resources into as long as they're the ones taking the beating, you know. And I think that that's an important development. Obviously, Australia doesn't show much sign of that. And the Brits are, you know, helpless as far as trying to chart any kind of independent course. But, you know, it's kind of interesting to watch what's transpiring right now.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll kind of have to see how that plays out. I had my friend Kyle Anzalone on, who works for the Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com. And we talked about that, I want to say, like the day or two after that. And yeah, that whole situation was very interesting. So one other country I want to ask you about, and I'm sure you might recall this, but India. So China and India had troops on their border that were like fist fighting on top of the mountains. If I remember correctly, there were no deaths. And if there was, I think it was only one or two, but there were literal troops from each country fist fighting on top of a mountain. And I remember seeing the video of it. It's like this giant snowy field, and there's these people just beating the snot out of each other. So what's the relation with China and India? And obviously we know that India is now the most populous country in the entire world.
Yep.
So what's kind of going on there?
Well, that's a super complex relationship that again, is in part shaped by the legacies of the colonial period and all that. You know, the border between China and India, it remains even today, an unresolved set of issues. There's issues in two areas, in the northwest, which is where the up in the high mountains, those snowy peaks and all that stuff. Mm. And then in the east, between sort of beyond where Bangladesh is, up on the north side there of India. Those are two separate arenas. Not a lot goes on the eastern end of things. But up in the high country there in the west, it's exactly as you describe. You know, both sides have been very careful not to put a lot of people who are cold and probably a little anxious and frustrated, not to give them live weapons, you know, but still, yeah, you see these, you know, it's one guy pushes another guy and then they're slugging it out. And then somebody brings a board and hits somebody over the head with it. It is crazy. There have been some deaths, not a big number by any means, but you know, there've been a few people, mostly, I'm sorry to say, you know, on the Indian side, but apparently one of these clashes a year or so ago, a number of guys fell off like a cliff. I don't think they were like beaten to death or anything, but they fell. That's how they died. Anyway, that's one arena of that's, you know, a very concrete, specific kind of arena of tension between them. And there's actually been some recent developments on that. The Indian prime minister, you know, met with Xi Jinping, and their foreign ministers have been meeting, and they've signed some agreements, not resolving the border delineation, but establishing a new framework for pursuing that, you know. So we'll see where that goes. But on a broader level, yeah. You know, the contrast of India and China after independence for India and after the revolution for China has been fairly stark. I mean, China has, you know, extended the life expectancy of its people. It's raised its GDP, if we want to use that kind of measure. It's lifted hundreds and hundreds of millions of people out of absolute poverty. You know, I mean, everybody has seen what China has accomplished. India, one has to say, has its economy has grown, but so much of that growth is eaten up by population growth that and there's no effort on the part of India to try to address that concern. China, of course, took a lot of heat about that, but in the end, the Chinese people are pretty solidly have a pretty solid perspective on that in retrospect. So India remains, it's a very poor country for hundreds of millions of people. It's a country where opportunity is very unequally distributed. There are places, Bangalore and Mumbai and places like that, where, you have lots of prosperity and rising middle class and young entrepreneurs and all that. That's all cool. But then you have massive amounts, hundreds of millions of people in the countryside who are just scraping by, just barely making it, And of course, the current leadership there, the BJP, this Hindu nationalist party, they've got some really terrible policies towards, religious or ethnic minority groups. It's the so-called world's greatest democracy, simply in numeric terms, it's horrible in terms of how the majority treats minority populations, So there's a lot of very stark contrasts between China and India. On the other hand, India also is a country that doesn't want to simply be a dependency of the United States. India can see very clearly that the age of Western dominance, the age of American hegemony, if you want to call it that, is over, and that the world is changing. There's a reason that India is part of BRICS, this developing country alliance, which is now much bigger than its original members. What is it? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Now there's, I think, a dozen more new countries that have joined in. That's an emerging force. It's not a highly unified thing, but there's enough commonality of interest in not being dominated by the West, in finding alternative sort of financial infrastructures, settlements of international payments, not using the dollar, other kinds of mechanisms. So there's common interests between China and India, and the question again is how do you chart that path going forward? And I think that the relationship between India and Russia has been very interesting. They are probably the two countries doing the most economic trade and exchange outside the dollar system. They settle their purchases and exchanges in either rubles or rupees. And then they have ways of exchanging those back and forth. So they've really charted a lot of a new path there. The United States, of course, really, really, really wants to keep India on its side. But that's not, they're not playing that role. They have not voted in favor of American resolutions in the Security Council or in the General Assembly in the UN, criticizing Russia, condemning Russia. India has abstained from those. So I think that's the situation with India is very interesting. I would like to see, I'd like to see them resolve the border conflict. I'd like to see them develop greater economic cooperation and not, fall vulnerable to that idea of competition. Why can't they? These are the two biggest populations, and they have the potential to be the two biggest economies in the world, as they were for many, many centuries before the Industrial Revolution and European imperialism came along. Why can't they find ways to go back to that? I'm hopeful that they will. And there's been, again, as I say, some recent indications, some good exchanges, government to government and all that. But they need to do more. They need to get down in the trenches a little more in terms of resolving the border and investment issues and things like that.
Interesting. So when I was talking about my friend earlier, and he mentioned he was concerned about China in some respect, I kind of shared a similar sentiment as to you shared just right there. My hope would be that we could export our electric vehicles. So I work for General Motors as a technician. I would love to see, Chinese people running around in electric Hummers, Cadillac Lyric, you know, maybe the Blazer EV, all the GM electric vehicles that we make here in America. And then, you know, we can maybe get some of the Chinese electric vehicles in for, you know, lower class people who maybe can't afford the, you know, $70,000 to $160,000 that we're charging for an electric Escalade, or $130,000 for a electric Hummer. So I really do envision a world where we could all kind of cooperate together, because you can't have two nuclear superpowers. And I mean, we're already flirting with it with Russia, but you know, I'm sure you know just as well as I do, and I try to preach this all the time on the show, is that China is the main, you know, the main enemy here, where, or at least from the United States perspective, they're gearing up for a war with China.
Yes.
Russia's just kind of like, you know, a stepping stone, but, you know, Lloyd Austin, Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden, his whole State Department, and then, you know, once again, a lot of the people under Trump are kind of all looking at China saying, hey, you're next. Don't get too carried away. But, you know, like I said, I would like to see more cooperation, much like you.
Yeah. You know, the coming years, until American political elites, and it's going to have to happen, just as there's a bipartisan antagonism now, they're going to have to, both sides of the aisle are going to have to figure out that these changes are not going to be reversed. They're not going to be stopped. They're, you know, it's not that China wants to become the new hegemonic power and dominate the world. What we're seeing is a multi-centric world, a world that's much more like the way it was all the way down to the end of the 18th century, you know, that brief period, the 19th, 20th centuries, when, you know, the monopoly on modern industrial technologies of production was maintained, you know, in the Atlantic world, as they sometimes say, Western Europe, North America, with Japan eventually as a little outlier. That monopoly's gone, you know, and you know, so that's what BRICS is all about. These are modern developing economies. China's at the forefront of that, but it's by no means the only one. Malaysia has a super sophisticated economy, modern technological economy. Even Indonesia, which is struggling, you know, they're making great strides. India has a lot of, you know, great computer and tech stuff, you know. South Africa's in the game. Brazil's in the game. Argentina, Chile, you know, there's a lot going on. It's not just, oh, well, America's going down and China's going to be the new top dog. It's much more nuanced and multi-centric than that. And that's part of why, you know, you can throw these obstacles in China's path, but that's not going to change the overall pattern of transformation, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that if American elites could get over themselves, you know, we could face a much better future. But the danger is that a lot of people who have really bad ideas about this stuff have been and may continue to be the ones calling the shots, you know, and it is very dangerous. It's a very dangerous situation. In some ways I hope that the confusion and contradiction within the new administration may blunt that, you know, but we'll have to see. You know?
Right. Yeah. And hopefully, like you said, that's kind of the situation, or cooler heads prevail, which I generally think they will. So I want to be respectful of your time, but I got a couple more things I want to ask you about. So the one thing that propagated all over the media conveniently after Trump formed his little CIA outfit, specifically aimed at fighting a propaganda war with China. And I think it was February 2019. A lot of the claims came out in the following year that China was committing genocide against ethnic Uyghur Muslims in the Xinjiang province. And there's a lot that kind of goes into this whole story. So I've laid this out quite a bit on the show with different guests before, but I'm curious your perspective and kind of how you break it down.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the genocide rhetoric is. I mean, A, it's irresponsible, and B, it's simply inaccurate. You know, there is no genocide taking place in Xinjiang or any place else in China. You know, it's just not what's happening. You know, I think one interesting recent wrinkle with this is, of course, that there's been some I don't know if we want to call them revelations, but some recognitions at least that the situation in Syria recently, this overthrow of the Assad regime and all this, one of the significant components of the jihadist forces there have been Uyghur fighters, exiled Uyghur fighters, who now are saying, we've learned so much, we're ready to go. We're taking on the Chinese. We're going to infiltrate into Xinjiang, and we're going to wage the same kind of campaign there that we have successfully been a part of here in Syria. Well, that's clearly not going to happen. But the very fact that this gets reported, that these forces, which have been in part financed and trained by CIA, the Chinese are not making this stuff up. There are separatist forces that would like to split away Xinjiang province from the rest of China, and that's just a political reality. And they have been willing within China in the past, in the recent past, to carry out acts of terrorism. I was living in Beijing, 25 years or so ago. There was a bus blown up on one of the main shopping streets by Xinjiang, separatists. And they issued statements, and that's what went on. There have been these knife attacks in railway stations and things like that. And within Xinjiang itself, there have been lots of these, a pretty small scale, but still, attacks on police stations, isolated outposts, things like that. So there is a separatist movement, an Islamic fundamentalist separatist movements that want to create a sort of Taliban-like regime in Xinjiang. They want to subject the people of that region to, an Islamic fundamentalist state. And that is not the wish of the vast majority of the people there, but there are these elements, and that's what the Chinese have been trying to, suppress and root out and all that. But Xinjiang, it has been historically, 19th, 20th century, certainly, a poorer region. It's the interior, it's Central Asia, it's dry, a lot of it is desert. It has not been the most prosperous, it wasn't the prosperous part of the Qing dynasty or the Republic or the PRC, but they're trying to develop it economically. And so, as things would happen, it's ironic in many ways, the global environmental crisis, the crisis of fossil fuels, has actually turned out to be kind of a beneficial thing in Xinjiang, because a lot of the development that's going on there is alternative energy, wind, solar. These are big things. There's also a lot of oil out there, ironically enough, and that's been developed as well. But Xinjiang is at the forefront of some of these alternative energy initiatives that the Chinese are pursuing. So you have a situation where people have occupational opportunities, they have employment opportunities, working, for the oil companies or for the wind turbine builders or for the solar, arrays that are being built. Working maybe in constructing infrastructure, the transmission lines and all that kind of stuff, and other kinds of economic activities. Of course, cotton is a big thing out there. Volkswagen has a big production facility outside of Urumqi. So economic development, building the economy, improving the material standard of living for people, that's an ongoing effort on the part of the Chinese government. What that involves, though, is education. And education to integrate people into the modern economic realm, It's not suppressing Islam. It's not suppressing Uyghur language. All the schools teach both Uyghur and Chinese. But for young people, if young people want to get an education and they want to get jobs and they want to get good paying jobs in growing sectors of the economy, they're going to learn Chinese. And, all over the world, we see the phenomenon that as economies modernize and populations become better educated, so-called traditional culture undergoes changes. You know, I lived for many years in Boston, mm-hmm. and the Catholic Church there. I mean, a lot of churches have been shut down because there's not enough priests. Because young people, they don't want to become priests. They don't want to be involved in to that degree. They don't want to give up a lot of the things that you would have to do that. Well, young people in Xinjiang or in Tibet, this is exactly the same dynamic up there. They want to be part of the modern world. They want, they want to listen to their music. They want to get a good job. They want to, maybe have a nice car, whatever it might be. The erosion of traditional culture, and that's going on. It's not Chinese communist propaganda and suppression. It's the temptations of the modern world, maybe what we want is for the people of Xinjiang to be put in a little glass case and kept as a relic of the past, out there, herding their camels or something. But that's not what those people want. And they don't want to be suppressed. They don't want to be told that they can't, dance or listen to music, that the men have to grow long beards. They don't want to be told that stuff, right? So, it's just the idea that there's some sort of cultural genocide or worse, a real human genocide going on. It's just absurd. It doesn't line up with reality. Are there tensions? Are there frictions between, Uyghur people or Kazakh people or Uzbek people, because there's lots of Muslim groupings there, and Han ethnic Chinese people? Sure, there's got to be frictions. That's social life. That's change. That's modernity, But does that amount to repression and what are they talk about concentration camps or like a Chinese gulag? There's no actual evidence of that. People who go there, and I've been there, I've been to Xinjiang. That's not what you see. I've been to Tibet, same thing. Yeah, that's not what you see. It's not. You go to Lhasa, you go to the Jokang, the big central market and temple. You got pilgrims prostrating themselves. It's a lively, dynamic culture. But young people want to modernize. They want to wear their T-shirts and not have to be, out scraping the ground, So it's modernity. It's development. And there's contradictions in that. I get that. But let's not pretend that it's some sort of genocidal campaign. For one thing, the population, the Uyghur population in China, the census keeps showing them getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. It's just not a reality. It's propaganda. And they rely upon the fact that most Americans are never going to go there. They're never going to have any direct evidence or experience of that. So they can believe it because it's far away and mysterious, And it's cynical and it's manipulative and it's reckless and irresponsible. But that's what our leaders choose to do these days.
Yeah, unfortunately. One other thing would be, what's your thoughts on the Falun Gong and the Epoch Times? If I would assume you're probably familiar with those.
Oh yeah, well, the Falun Gong is a cult. It's a nut job cult. They believe that they are a chosen people who are the agents of a interplanetary civilizing force that's going to transform human society. They believe that when they are adopted into the Falun Gong movement, that they are implanted with a certain sort of spinning energy wheel inside of their bodies that gives them a higher sort of spiritual being or something like that. It is a even more than most religions, delusional system that is run by a Chinese exile who lives in a multi-million dollar penthouse in New York City that's paid for by ordinary people who have fallen into the web of this cult. So I have obviously not a very positive view of Falun Gong. They made one big mistake, one big miscalculation back at the, 30 so years or so ago, where they decided that they were going to directly confront the Chinese government. And, they had their people come into the capital and surround the government sort of center right down in central Beijing, and sort of, you know, like, you know, look what we can do. You better, you know, you better get set to turn things over to us. Well, that was a stupid move. And you know, obviously the no government is going to respond to that in a positive way. And so, yeah, I mean, Falun Gong is banned and suppressed in China. You know, we have our own examples of that. Anybody that's ever thought about what happened with the Branch Davidians in Waco knows that the idea of freedom of religion has its very, very stark limits in this country. You know, so getting all caught up in a hand-wringing contest over the Falun Gong is just, it's just a waste of time, because it's basically a nut job organization, and their propaganda, whether it's the Epic Times or these what is it, Shenyun, the dance group that goes around, you know, that's just Falun Gong propaganda, you know. So yeah, I turn a jaundiced eye towards them.
Yeah, and one other outlet that I know is also kind of associated with the Epic Times, New Tang Dynasty, and obviously the Falun Gong is China Uncensored. And one of their claims, which was just absolutely insane, is repeated on, if you're familiar with the Timcast show, they repeated the claims of there being alleged organ harvesting going on over in China.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's all, you know, this kind of stuff. It's funny, in the 19th century, when Western missionaries started showing up in China, those exact kinds of stories, you know, that they were eating babies and harvesting organs out of people and all this kind of stuff, not for medical purposes so much then, although maybe to extract medicines from them or something, those were directed at the foreigners, at the Westerners. Mm-hmm. And now, ironically enough, the same kinds of claims are directed by Westerners against China, as China has become a more successful and prosperous society. You know, these are they're just fantasies. They're just it's just made up shit that, you know, they want to use to demonize China. You know, how you gonna argue against it when there's nothing there, you know.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Professor Hammond, I really, really appreciate your time. And this was incredibly enlightening and educational. And hopefully all the listeners appreciate it as much as I did. As with always, anytime I talk to any of the foreign policy guys or guys who are much more knowledgeable than me on China, I always feel like I have to go back and listen to the show over again to make sure I got all this stuff cemented in my head. And we didn't even get to touch on BRICS, so I'd definitely love to have you back on for a follow-up. Maybe we could touch on that a little bit more. But sure, I want to be respectful of your time, so feel free, let everybody know where they can find you, support you, and you know, look for you if they want to find you.
Well, you know, I have a couple of books out, one of which that's called China's Revolution and the Quest for a Socialist Future is available on Amazon. If you just go into Amazon and put in Ken Hammond, you know, Ken Hammond China usually helps. That'll pop up. I have another book on Chinese foreign policy since 1949 that's just coming out. I hope it'll be up on Amazon soon. That's called China and the World, 1949 to 2024. Mm-hmm. It's available now from 1804 Books in New York, 1804books.com. But as I say, I hope that'll be up on Amazon pretty soon as well. So, you know, you have those things. And I work with an organization called Pivot to Peace, which tries to push back against the pivot to Asia mentality and all that. And we have a website and all that, you know, so you can Google Pivot to Peace and find us there. We've done webcasts and other things like that. So, and yeah, you know, I'm just sort of around. You can reach out to me. My email, I'll tell you, my email is khammond, khammond at NMSU, New Mexico State University, nmsu.edu. So, you know, I'm happy to hear from people. And yeah, there you have it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I think we'll close her out there. And thank you, everybody, so much for listening. And until next time, take care, everyone.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. all that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.